Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Grads, all this anxiety about getting into a good college. Let's call it a risky business.
Your stats are very respectable.
Doesn't anyone want to accomplish anything, or do we just want to make money?
Done some solid work here.
Make money. Make a lot of money.
I've got a trig midterm tomorrow, and I'm being chased by Guido, the killer pimp.
But it's not quite Ivy League now, is it?
Just take those old records off the shelf.
Oh, what's worth more? Good grades or a good head on your shoulders? The value of a good education may be different from the high cost of college tuition in this day and age. Tom Cruise did okay, and he's a high school dropout. More bad examples coming up on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, May 12th. Is college education worth it? Part of our Pomp in These Circumstances series for college grads. I'm John Hockenberry, joined today by Farai Chidea. Good morning, Farai.
Good morning. Yes, I think in order to be a radio host, it helps. But Peter Jennings had no high school diploma.
That's right.
Pretty amazing. Anyway, coming up this morning, we talk about the general changeup in Afghanistan. David McKiernan is out. Stanley McChrystal is in. We also get the dish on Cleveland Cavaliers' win last night. And as you mentioned, it's graduation season, and we're going to talk about how much that college degree is worth. Those stories coming up, but first these headlines.
And in the headlines, American journalist Roxana Sabiri says she's very happy to be free and reunited with her parents. These were her first public remarks since her release from an Iranian prison yesterday. She served 4 months on charges of spying for the U.S. She says she doesn't have any plans at the moment, but wants to spend time with her family. The Pakistani army says it has dropped officers by helicopter into a Taliban stronghold in the country's northwest Swat region. It's part of a broadening offensive against militants there. The officers will be in a remote area that's seen as a possible hiding place of the leader of the Taliban in the Swat province. Farai?
And speaking of Pakistan, the army estimates that 1.3 million people have fled fighting in the country's northwest since August. That's a massive figure. Those are people who fled the Swat Valley offensive, as well as another operation in the border region last year. And alleged Nazi war criminal John Demjanjuk is now in a German prison. He's 89 years old, arrived in Munich today. He is someone who worked in Ohio as an auto worker. He's now accused of the deaths of 29,000 people during the Holocaust. In Jerusalem, Pope Benedict is visiting a hilltop claimed as sacred by both Muslim and Jewish faiths. He removed his red papal shoes before entering the mosque at the Dome of the Rock. That's where Muslims believe the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven, and it's adjacent to a place revered in the Jewish faith, the Western Wall. And Chinese President Hu Jintao led a moment of silence today at a ceremony to mark the first anniversary of the Sichuan earthquake. 85,000 people are thought to have lost their lives in that quake.
Asian markets down today. Wall Street begins trading after a 2% decline at 84.19. That's the Dow. The S&P finished trading at 909. Is college worth it?
My undergraduate degree was completely worth it because I have one of the jobs that an undergraduate degree means a job, which is a civil engineer. Thank you.
Thinking about graduates and graduation, college degrees, that's the subject on The Takeaway in honor of graduates around the country. 8778-MY-TAKE. Is college worth it? My take at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea, and we're going to turn to this very tragic story in Baghdad. 5 U.S. service members were killed yesterday by a fellow soldier. The soldier was taken into custody, and the killings appear to be the single deadliest episode of soldier-on-soldier violence among U.S. troops since the invasion 6 years ago. Joining us from Baghdad is Ernesto Landaño. He's the Baghdad correspondent for The Washington Post. And Ernesto, the 5 servicemen were killed at a counseling center, and the initial speculation speculation, of course, is that the shootings were stress-related. Do we have any more information about the shooting and the shooter?
We have very little information about the shooter. We know at this point that he is an Army sergeant, and he was at Camp Liberty, which is a large military base near the Baghdad International Airport. The shooting happened at approximately 2 p.m., and sources tell us it happened inside the combat stress clinic. Most U.S. military bases have combat stress clinics.
Now, do we know anything more about the victims, whether or not, for example, they were also, I don't know if we know whether they were patients or being counseled or had a personal relationship to the shooter. Any sense of that?
At this point, we don't know what, if any, relationship there was between the gunman and the victims. There's two types of people who would ordinarily be at these clinics. People who are there seeking counseling and service members whose job it is to counsel others and to run the clinic.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just have a little bit of tape from Defense Secretary Robert Gates at a press briefing.
We're still in the process of gathering information on exactly what happened, but if the preliminary reports are confirmed, such a tragic loss of life at the hands of our own forces is a cause for great and urgent concern. And I can assure you that it will get this department's highest priority attention.
So, Ernesto, do we have any sense, aside from this sense of remorse and regret, how the military is dealing with this tragedy?
I think this is going to put a spotlight on the shortcomings of the mental health system in the military. In recent years, as service members have been coming to Iraq and into Afghanistan for lengthy, repeated tours, the stress of these deployments has really taken a toll on service members. And sometimes some of these invisible wounds don't really surface until months or years after incidents that were traumatic. I know that commanders and squad leaders on the ground are paying a lot of attention to this, and have attempted to ease the stigma associated with seeking mental health help. But clearly there are still there's still a lot of progress that needs to be made in this area, and I think it's safe to say that this incident is going to get those efforts a renewed sense of urgency.
Ernesto, is it safe to say, finally, that an incident of this kind really ripples through the ranks and that soldiers everywhere in theater are going to know about this, learn about this, and have a sense of vigilance and wariness?
Absolutely. I think I spoke to several service members who were stationed at the compound where this occurred yesterday. People were really, really shaken. They were really taken aback. I think one of the aspects of this that made it particularly unsettling was the fact that people feel pretty safe at the Victory Base compound, which includes Camp Liberty. This is sort of a city within a city. It's a place where you have large dining facilities, stores, fast food restaurants, and it is a place sort of far removed from the more dangerous parts of this country. One key thing to note about this case is that soldiers carry weapons on base pretty much all the time. And these weapons, when they're on base, generally should be unloaded. And when soldiers enter places like dining facilities or clinics, most of the time at the entrance, there's somebody checking to make sure that the weapon is unloaded to prevent an accidental shooting. In this case, based on what we know so far, it's hard to believe that this was an accidental shooting.
All right. Well, Ernesto, thanks so much for your time. That was Ernesto Londano, Baghdad correspondent for The Washington Post. John?
And stress is rippling throughout eastern Afghanistan. Multiple suicide bombers have attacked government buildings in eastern Afghanistan. The Associated Press is reporting or quoting an Interior Ministry spokesman by the name of Zamiri Bashari saying, we don't know about casualties, but another sign of the stress and the tension in the Afghanistan battlefield. And the Pentagon announced yesterday that it's replacing the top American commander in Afghanistan. Here's Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who made the announcement yesterday.
After consultation with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the commander of Central Command, and with the approval of the President, I have asked for the resignation of General David McKiernan. He will remain in command of both ISAF and U.S. Forces Afghanistan until such time as relief can be nominated and confirmed.
Without getting too much into the acronyms there, Gates' choice to replace McKiernan is Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal. He's a former Special Operations Commander. Joining us now is retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner. Gardner has taught strategy and military operations at the National War College. Good morning, Colonel, and help me to understand what this means here.
It's a big deal. It's a major decision that reflects... let me say a couple historical things about this. Normally, you don't replace commanders during combat. One of the reasons you don't is because it has an effect on the troops. The troops will interpret this or question, is this because I'm not doing a good job? That's the first thing. The second thing is, normally commanders are replaced because their strategy is bad. In this case, he's being replaced because of the Washington-based strategy.
Well, let's talk about that for just a second. He's been on for less than a year, right?
Yes. I think what we're seeing is the White House believes they have 2 years in Afghanistan to get things sorted out before they lose public support and European support. The real question is whether or not an insurgency can be fought under a timeline like that.
Well, I want to talk about the tension in the Pentagon between the sort of special ops insurgency gang and this kind of traditional army gang in a moment. But Bob Gates is known as a kind of a quiet, incremental systems guy, friend of everyone in the Pentagon. Do you think this is out of character for him to do this, and maybe he was directed from the White House?
Well, I don't. The way he talked about it, it seems as if it were a collective decision.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed to name everybody. That may be to push the blame around. But I think it reflects their concern that the Afghan strategy is not going to work. And they're trying to do everything they can. A fascinating article in a Canadian paper this morning. The commander of Canadian troops praised McKiernan for being the kind of person we needed in this kind of job. The significance of this is that this is the Americans who seem to be going their own way. This is a NATO fight, but more and more it is a Washington-based fight, and that's going to mean we're going to lose support from the NATO allies as we go forward.
Well, Colonel Sam Gardner, retired from the National War College, you're speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Just want to remind our listeners, and we're going to hold you into the next segment. But before we end this segment, this is not the first time that the magic answer to battlefield problems is more special ops. Rumsfeld did that again and again in Iraq and even in the initial invasion of Afghanistan. Is this the kind of thing that produces tension within the Pentagon?
I'm not sure it does. I think it's more the strategy's clear. There was a White House review, a Central Command review, and the U.S. strategy has these three pillars: the military security part, making governance work, and then building development. So there's a long-range vision for Afghanistan. I think that's going to stay. I think they were looking not making the tension between special operations and regular, but they were looking for someone who probably had a can-do attitude when one ought to be cautious about can-do. This may be a can't-do, but they wanted someone who would say, I can do it.
So he's the exit strategy guy? That's a potential headline here.
Yeah, no, he's the guy who says, well, I think it'll work. McKiernan may have been cautious.
One
of the objectives they had was to do this militia-based strategy, which is to build not Afghan forces but militias in the smaller areas.
Well, we're going to talk about some more of those details and particularly the nation-building idea in Afghanistan when we get back after a short break. Retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner, stay with us. Colonel Gardner taught strategy and military operations at the National War College, and we're talking about the replacement of General David McKiernan in Afghanistan, a yank of the chain of command in Afghanistan, and what it means for nation-building and the development of forces, NATO and otherwise, in Afghanistan. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Lots to talk about this morning. Tragic shooting in Iraq and also suicide bombings, multiple suicide bombings in eastern Afghanistan. We're continuing with retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner, who taught strategy and military operations at the National War College. He joins us from Washington to talk about the replacement announced yesterday of General David McKiernan in Afghanistan by Secretary Robert Gates Choice. He's the Secretary of Defense, Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal, to command Afghan operations as a former special operations commander. So before we go, Colonel Gardner, is it fair to say that you believe this appointment or this change is a sign that Gates and the Obama administration want U.S. forces to be more aggressive, more go it alone, in addition to the nation building that was already going on there?
I think that will be the consequence of it, because in Secretary Gates' discussion yesterday, he never mentioned the NATO allies. He never mentioned that this was discussed with them. He never mentioned the trust that McKiernan had built with NATO commanders that were there. This was about American strategy, and that's about moving in a direction that is going to cause less or give us less support.
Now, that's a huge change, if I'm reading you correctly, because the Bush administration was meticulous about saying coalition. Every other word was coalition. Our NATO allies, coalition, getting other troops to be in theater. Are we moving away from that?
Well, I think the need to hurry is causing a frustration that is forcing the movement away from that. You know, when President Obama visited the Pentagon and talked about Afghanistan, he asked the assembled military leadership, what's the end game in Afghanistan? He didn't get a very good answer. I'm not sure we have a good answer. The current selection of McKiernan to deal with the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda doesn't produce an end state. We don't seem to have a vision for end state, only a vision for what we want Afghanistan not to be. That's not a great end state.
Last question, Colonel. I'm a special ops lieutenant on the ground outside of Kabul. This is my second deployment. I've heard this news. Am I a happy camper or not?
You probably are, because it reinforces what you have done. If you're a regular troop, you probably feel a little down by it. What have we done wrong? Have we been betrayed? Is this more of Gates' irregular warfare? Where are we going? Do we have an end state?
All right. A great takeaway there. Retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner joining us from Washington, D.C. He taught strategy and military operations at the National War College, talking about the change of command in Afghanistan. Farai?
Thanks, John. So it is graduation season. Do you think you got enough value out of your degree?
College is worth it primarily because 95% of job applications require some sort of bachelor's degree. And because it's an electronic process, if it's not listed, one is never called.
All right. Some people have gotten into as much as $150,000 in debt for college. Is it worth it? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake@thetakeaway.org.
All right, let's check in now. The NBA playoffs are underway, and if you were watching last night, it was a low-scoring bludgeoning by the Cleveland Cavaliers who ended the Atlanta Hawks' attempt to even maintain a presence in the playoffs. It was another sweep. Meanwhile, the Dallas Mavericks stayed in there with a lot of heart in a high-scoring game against the Denver Nuggets. Here to put it all in context, Ibrahim Abdelmateen, sports blogger and Takeaway Sports contributor right here in the studio. So that was some pretty interesting basketball, but it's all about about LeBron James, correct, Ibrahim?
LeBron James is the king. Last week he was crowned the king of the NBA by getting his MVP, and he got the MVP at his high school. But right now the story is about his banks that are too big to fill and stadiums too big to fill and his speedy NBA point guards that are too fast to catch. It's all about the fast guards in the NBA right now.
You're too cool for school, Ibrahim, I have to say. Let's talk about the bio, the resume of LeBron James here. He's the standout player, as you've mentioned, the Cleveland Cavaliers. I remember in the early days of Michael Jordan playing for the hapless Chicago Bulls, he was fantastic, but they couldn't win, and they didn't do very well in the playoffs in the early going. It's all on the line here for LeBron James. He's got to make it to the championship here, it seems.
I think what happened was that you showed with Jordan and Magic and these guys, you showed that you have to put a team around them that can really support them and really accentuate their good qualities. LeBron James so far in the playoffs has averaged 33 points a game.
Wow.
And in his past series, up until this past game last night, he scored 109 points on 108 minutes. He scored an incredible amount of points in a really short amount of time. He is a force of nature, and he could make any team good.
And the team is helping him out, though. I mean, this is a double sweep in the playoffs by double digits, 8 games in a row. That's never been done, and an 8-game sweep has only been done once before.
Definitely. I think they actually remind me of the UConn women's basketball team
that you were talking about last month. Finally, the heart and the smarts of the Dallas Mavericks. Do they have longevity here? Can they make it past the Nuggets?
Everybody knows about those soccer coach parents that go crazy when their kids don't do good and they yell at the coaches. Well, that's the coach of the Dallas Mavericks. Cuban, and they got this little guy, J.J. Barreras.
He's the owner, right?
And So this Puerto Rican guy, J.J. Barreras, who his favorite basketball player growing up was Jason Kidd. He's playing alongside him. Right now, the Dallas Mavericks are playing with all heart, and I don't think they're going to be able to pull it out at all. I mean, no team has ever done what they're trying to do, come back from 3-0. But it was courageous last night.
And standing, waiting for all comers, the Lakers.
Which is, well, not yet, not quite. You know, Yao Ming went down, he broke his right foot in the era of let's transform healthcare. Yao Ming breaks his right foot and he goes down, and who comes up? Hopefully the scrappy, tough, hard-nosed Rockets, a bunch of rangy guys will be able to do it. Aaron Brooks, who's in his second year in the NBA, scored his 34 points the other night. So they came with an emotional win, but it's not set in stone yet.
Right.
And so yeah.
If the Lakers advance, and this is a Lakers-LeBron James series, which you've talked about earlier, and
definitely,
I think everybody hopes will be the case, but it's not set in stone by any means. There are other teams in there. It's going to be the first time that there won't be a kind of Eastern style versus a Western style. It's going to be two teams with two stars who are relatively similar. It's sort of the old days.
Well, except for the fact that LeBron James does stuff that Kobe Bryant can't do. And the same thing for Kobe. Kobe is a clutch guy. He'll knock down a shot at the end of the game. LeBron has yet to prove that he can truly do that when it matters the most.
Lots to prove. Stakes couldn't be higher, but we're still just in the middle of the NBA playoffs.
And don't forget about Denver. Denver is the best team in the NBA right now.
All right. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, sports blogger, Takeaway sports contributor. If you have a comment on your team, leave it on our website at thetakeaway.org. And stay tuned for all of Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen's blog posts as the NBA playoffs continue. Thanks, Ibrahim.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea, and right now we have Femi Oke with the headlines. Hey.
Hello there. 32 minutes past the hour is the time. The Afghan government has called on the new commander of American forces in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, to help reduce civilian casualties there. The government also asked the general to increase the quality and quantity of Afghan forces. Defense Secretary Gates appointed McChrystal to the post, saying the U.S. command needs a shake-up.
We have a new policy set by our new president. We have a new strategy, a new mission, and a new ambassador. I believe that new military leadership also is needed.
McChrystal will replace General David McKiernan pending Senate approval. Afghan officials say that teams of suicide bombers and insurgents attacked two government buildings today in the eastern city of Khost, sparking running gun battles. Armed insurgents took government workers hostage and ambushed an American reaction force. Officials say that at least six people have been killed in the attacks. The suspected Nazi death camp guard, John de Jamjuk, has been transferred to a German prison after months of legal wrangling. The question remains whether he's medically fit to stand trial. The 89-year-old Ukrainian-born former Ohio auto worker is accused of accessory to murder in the deaths of 29,000 people in Nazi-occupied Poland. He says he himself was a prisoner and didn't hurt anybody. Back in the United States, a day after receiving pledges from healthcare providers that they will trim costs by $2 trillion over 10 years, the president has some more meetings with business leaders on health costs today. Meanwhile, the Health and Human Services Chief, Kathleen Sebelius, says that she's confident that health industry leaders will make good on their promises. And finally, out in space, the crew of Atlantis will spend today checking the shuttle for any launch damage. It's racing toward the Hubble Space Telescope for a repair mission that's especially dangerous because all of the space junk in the telescope's 350-mile-high orbit. And that's a look at your news for now.
Hey, got one for you. Trade deficit widens. You predicted it would widen. You were right. That's what just came out. This recession cuts into export sales.
And thanks, John.
Sure. Hitachi lost $8 billion. Ouch. A lot more than I have in my bank account.
Any more news from anybody else?
No.
The repertory cast of newsmakers today?
We're all in it together.
You didn't like what I did?
We're all in it together. I want to move on to a very serious story. Sri Lanka is described by the UN as a, quote, bloodbath. More than 100 children dead this weekend alone. 50,000 Sri Lankan civilians still reportedly trapped between Tamil Tiger rebels and government forces. Today, the Red Cross in Sri Lanka says it can't deliver essential supplies to the conflict zone in the northeast, can't evacuate sick and wounded people. To find out what's happening in Sri Lanka, the Takeaway spoke with the head of the BBC's Tamil section, Manivanna Tirumule, in London earlier this morning. And when we spoke, I asked Manny what he'd been hearing from his listeners.
We haven't been hearing much from listeners, but we have been talking to the rebel leaders, the government doctors still working in the rebel-controlled area, which is now called a no-fire zone by the government, but which is subjected to fire from both sides. And we have also been hearing from ICRC and United Nations officials based in Colombo. What we hear is not really good news. Basically, the fighting is still raging on. Government forces today have been inching forward into the remaining bit of the territory. And there is fighting going on, and there is loss of life.
Now, I was lucky enough to visit Sri Lanka about a year ago, and the Tamils are an ethnic group. The Sinhalese, the majority of folks in the government, are a larger ethnic group. What do we need to know about the background of this conflict, which has resulted in suicide bombings, conventional warfare bombings? What do we need to know about the background?
Well, the story is very simple. The country became independent from Britain in 1948. Ever since, the two major communities in the island, the Sinhalese, who form nearly 70 to 72%, and the Tamils, who form another 18%, they have always been at loggerheads with each other over political differences, and that the differences basically persisted on economic and social opportunities vis-a-vis employment, education, etc. The Tamils feeling deprived of opportunities which they were enjoying in the British colonial era. These political differences were, debated and discussed on the political platform till about mid-70s. But the Sri Lankan state failed to address these grievances in a political way, according to many observers, which led to the differences assuming the form of an armed insurgency right. in the 80s.
Well, Mani, we have to let you go, but thank you so much. Mani Vana Thirumulai. Now we have Charles Haviland, BBC correspondent, joins us from the Sri Lankan capital of Colombo. What's the latest on the ground?
Well, I've actually just been speaking to one of the spokespeople for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Colombo, and she has said that it was not possible to land their ship in the small remaining pocket of fighting today. She's saying, and I'm quoting directly, the prevailing ground situation prevented that. Just to put you a little bit in the picture, they have a ship called the Green Ocean that sails up from the large town of Trincomalee, that's down the coast from the small area of fighting. It is trying to put in every single day to deposit foods and medicines, which are essential, and bring out up to about 500 of the most sick and worst wounded people. That's more or less the capacity of the ship. They haven't managed to land and carry out that humanitarian mission since Saturday. And when they refer to the prevailing situation on the ground, you can be sure that what they mean, in their very diplomatic way of speaking, is that there is fierce fighting and that it would just be too dangerous to land and to try and evacuate people. So it's very, very grim news at all, as Mani was saying.
Well, just quickly, the situation was discussed at the UN yesterday. So did anything come out of that, any commitments?
The situation was discussed on the sidelines of UN Security Council meeting. Now, some strong words were said. The British and French foreign ministers and a senior Austrian diplomat who I also believe was the foreign minister both spoke to the press quite extensively afterwards. Basically, countries, including those three countries, would like the issue of Sri Lanka to be raised at the level of the UN Security Council, as indeed with the United States. They say it is not only a severe humanitarian situation, they say it has international repercussions. They're looking at the anger of many of the Tamil diaspora.
Right.
Just to remind you that these are mainly Tamil civilians inside the Tamil Tiger-controlled zone.
And that was BBC correspondent Charles Haviland in an interview conducted earlier this morning, John.
You're talking about inching forward in a space the size of Central Park there. It gives you an idea of just the tension and the brutality. Well, on a quite a different subject, we're talking about the value of a college degree. John writes us to say, I think a college education is totally worth the debt as long as you attend at least a second-tiered national university or liberal arts college and you major in a discipline like accounting, information systems, or mathematics. What do you think a college education is worth? We're going to talk about that in a little while here on The Takeaway, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. The suspected Nazi death camp guard John Demjanjuk has arrived in Germany today. He faces a warrant accusing him of being accessory to the murder of 29,000 people, mainly Jews. The retired auto worker from Ohio was deported from the U.S., arrived this morning on a private jet at Munich's airport. He's 89 years old. He's going to be brought before a judge, formally arrested. And earlier this morning, I spoke with BBC correspondent Tristana Moore in Berlin. And in our interview, I asked Tristana if, given Demjanjuk's age, again, 89, could this be the last ever Nazi war crimes trial?
Yes, it could indeed be one of Germany's last Nazi war crimes trial, if it actually ever gets to court. I mean, at the moment, there are still questions over whether or not Demjanjuk is fit to stand trial. And as he arrived today at Munich Airport, his Learjet touched down, an ambulance was waiting there. at the airport. He was then taken away on a stretcher, showing just how old and frail he is at 89 years old. And he's now been transferred to Stadelheim prison, where he's being held in the hospital wing of the jail. And it's likely that he will undergo a medical test later today to determine whether or not he's fit to stand trial.
What do we know about the evidence in this trial that points to him being this guard and being culpable in the murder of tens of thousands of people?
Well, German prosecutors haven't revealed all the evidence, but they do say they have a number of documents which show his Nazi background, including, crucially, this SS identity card, which shows that he was transferred to the death camp in Sobibor in 1943. Prosecutors also say they have a number of other transfer orders and papers and documents proving that he was in Sobibor, as well as many witnesses. And so they claim that they have enough evidence to bring him to trial, and that's their aim. However, his lawyer here in Germany has already said that he is too frail and unwell to take part in this trial. So over the next few days, the question is going to be, is he fit enough to stand trial?
One of the fascinating things about this case is that this man, if these reports are accurate of what he did, led two very different lives. And an Ohio auto worker and a Nazi camp guard is two very different lives. What is the interest in Germany about the narrative of Demjanjuk's life?
Yeah, well, there is great interest in this trial, and Germans have been following the legal shenanigans from the very beginning. I mean, after all, there have been so many legal challenges, not only in America, but also here in Germany. His lawyers filing legal challenges here in the courts to try to block his deportation. We've seen him almost on this plane in America a few times over the last couple of months. But really, the crucial thing came in March when the prosecutors in Munich issued this arrest warrant for him. And it really was then quite serious and only a matter of time before Demjanjuk would be deported to Germany. And many Jewish leaders here have already welcomed his arrival in Germany and mm-hmm. say that the authorities have to get this trial going as quickly as possible.
That was BBC correspondent Tristana Moore in an interview conducted earlier this morning. And John, it's one of those truth stranger than fiction stories, the double life of what appears to be a Nazi.
Well, the Demjanjuk trial, I think, is the longest extradition trial for war crimes in the history of international jurisprudence.
Fascinating. Thanks.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Good morning, everyone. Graduation time. In about a minute, we're going to talk about the value of a college degree. We're going to do some math. But Jason from New York decided college was not for him.
I did not go to college, but I spent 2 years in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery studying as a monk. And then I came back and taught myself how to program computers and still making six figures. No college.
So tell us your bootstrap story, or how valuable is your college degree if you have one? Tell us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now Femi Oke, a college graduate, has some headlines for us.
12 minutes to the top of the hour, and I didn't pay for a penny of it, but that's the old days of the Labour government. Meanwhile, back in today's time, 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, everybody. A new economic indicator just out this morning. The international trade deficit widened in March. The change was expected as the recession cut into US export sales. A smiling Roxana Saberi greeted the media today in Tehran, saying that she's very happy to be reunited with her parents. An appeals court suspended her 8-year jail sentence yesterday, and she'd been convicted on charges of spying for the United States. The Pakistani army says that it has dropped officers by helicopters into a Taliban stronghold in the country's northwest Swat region. It's part of a broadening offensive against militants there. The officers will be in a remote area that's seen as a possible hiding place of the leader of the Swat Taliban. Pope Benedict is in Jerusalem, where he visited a hilltop claimed as sacred by both the Muslim and Jewish faiths. He went to the mosque at the Dome of the Rock, where Muslims believe the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven. And it's right next to a place revered in the Jewish faith, the Western Wall, where the Pope also visited. And finally, back in the United States, the golden brown voice of James Earl Jones will be heard at the White House tonight.
While I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door.
The force is strong with him.
That's James Earl Jones reading The Raven.
And Darth Vader.
Yes, I know that. Thank you. Sorry. For digressing, there will be plenty of poetry tonight as the President and First Lady host an evening of poetry, music and spoken word in the East Room. And the poetry slam will be streamed live at whitehouse.gov. I don't think you'd be doing The Force is Strong Within You, Mr. President.
Oh, wow. This is like public radio poetry slam. That's great.
What's wrong with you?
Really
great. How many cups of coffee have you drunk this morning? Enough. I'm cutting
you
off.
What happens to a dream deferred?
How much debt are you guys in from your college education? Anyone still
zero
paying
now.
Off?
Zero.
Nice. But yeah. $20,000 a year, that's the average. The average annual loan that a student takes on for undergraduate studies. Doesn't even count your graduate degree. So let's do some hard-edged analysis. Let's look at the value of a college degree in this day and age. And here to talk about the economic value of this credential is career counselor and higher education policy author Marty Nemko, speaking with us from Oakland, California. Let's get right to it, Marty. Is college worth it?
Depends. Alas, I can't give you black or white, but it depends on the person. If you are somebody who has done well in high school, are motivated to do well in school, are somebody who is not particularly entrepreneurial and is not a Bill Gates, and if you started a community college, then the answer is probably clearly yes. If the answer is to some of those are no, then the answer is probably not, because the actual value added in terms of learning is frighteningly low, according to the President's Spelling Commission and according to the Pew Trust Studies. And the value of the degree, even in monetary terms, is no longer what they say. You know, you're going to earn $1 million more over your lifetime. That's retrospective. It's much less likely to be true today, as we have many more college graduates. At the same time as employers are offshoring ever more white-collar jobs. So in short, it depends. It's no longer a slam dunk the way it used to be.
Now, is it worth to go into debt to get a bachelor's degree, or should you wait and go into debt for, say, more like your residency or going to med school or maybe law school, an advanced degree?
Well, the good news is there's no correlation between the cost of a college and the quality derived, and not only in terms of the quality of education. But let's say, you know, John, you're a Harvard-caliber guy, and you make a decision to save the money and go to a no-name state college or start at a community college. There are hidden advantages to doing that. Certainly, of course, you go to Harvard, you go to Stanford, of course, everybody knows that the brand name on that diploma is going to add value to you in the marketplace, and you will also be surrounded by bright kids, which will help just the quality of experience. However, if you go to a no-name state college, you are more likely to be taken under wing because you're going to stand out. If you're a bright guy at Harvard, or a woman, of course, you're just one of many. But if you stand out, you're going to have that one thing that really matters a lot, being taken under wing, being given leadership opportunities. Your GPA is going to be hired. You're going to have the time for the balance between academics and the extracurriculars that often do more to help you prime you for life and personal success than if you go to Harvard, where you're more likely to have an eating disorder. I don't know. This is an amazing story from a book, Six Women Who Went to Harvard and What Became of Them. They say they've got to change the pipes in the toilets very frequently in the women's dormitories because of all the vomiting from the stress-related eating disorders. The second most common complaint to the Student Health Service at Harvard is stress and burnout.
So, unbelievable.
Yeah, so there's a lot of benefits.
Believable. I went to Harvard.
You went to Harvard?
Yeah.
Well, Fry, go ahead. Does that?
I had an eating disorder, so hey, you know, put me in the demo.
Whoa.
I've written about it. So yeah. That's a whole nother story, as we like to say. But Marty, let me ask you this. There was, to get back to the practical money side of things, I read this story about this guy who racked up $150,000 in undergrad debt. Is that just wrong? I mean, shouldn't someone have said, hey, you can get some more grants, or hey, you might want to work more, and or hey, you're never going to be able to pay that back?
I think the right question is, first of all, why are colleges charging so much money? And the answers are not pretty. The answers are in part because every time we reflexively say how great we're going to add the amount of Pell Grants available and the amount of government-subsidized loans, we think that is aiding the affordability of college. In fact, it disproportionately lines the pockets of the colleges because the college is going to say, oh, good, more money is available from the government to the students so we can raise our tuitions. And that's what they do. That's one of the major reasons that the costs of college have exceeded inflation for so long. There's
so
no
financial aid actually fuels inflation. Well, here's a takeaway question for you, and that is, are we looking at, with all of the college indebtedness among students who are already out there, including the graduating class that are taking a look at college right now, are we looking at a kind of a mini subprime mortgage crisis with all of this college indebtedness?
Unfortunately, no, because the college lobby is so powerful that they have managed to do the unbelievable, which is the only kind of debt that you cannot discharge is a student loan. You cannot declare bankruptcy. You can declare bankruptcy on any other kind of loan, but you can't. So there's no, people can't default on it. So it's. You're really, really stuck.
How's that for an education? You're really stuck if you're in college debt. Marty Nemko, career counselor and author, speaking to us from Oakland, California. Get more suggestions from Marty at martynemko.com. Well, here's the value of a college education.
And
you're in debt for life.
Exactly, and folks have been talking about it. We've got Maureen from Detroit.
The value of a college education is it teaches people to think in a more logical and systematic way. It's not necessarily about the education. It's about teaching the brain to think.
But Charlie from New Jersey wishes he was more prepared before he went.
Most people don't know exactly what college degrees are worth until it's too late. For example, if someone had told me that the way to write a sitcom was to go to Harvard, I would have studied harder in high school.
And we have David who writes, college is not a trade school. If you never earn a dollar more, the experience is worth it so long as you don't major in underwater basket weaving.
It's a classical liberal arts education
approach.
All about the life of the mind.
Yes. Well, hey, you know, I love the life of the mind. I also got to pay my rent. What's the worth of your college degree? Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
You know, this is a NATO fight, but more and more it is a Washington-based fight, and that's going to mean we're going to lose support from the NATO allies as we go forward.
That's Colonel Sam Gardner talking about the decision to replace the top American commander in Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's the news this morning. McKiernan is out. McChrystal may be in if the Senate confirms him. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Okay, Mr. Mason, you've got 30 minutes to expose the liars.
Are you trying to shield someone, Mr. Byrd? Is that the reason you lied about hearing that shot when Miss Wallace was in the room?
No, I... All right, I did lie about that.
And it was you who called her on the telephone and induced you to come to your room. Yes.
Ugh, fictional lawyer Perry Mason could often find the liars in seconds. Getting people to break down on the witness stand happens a lot on TV. Real life? Totally different. I'm not lying. The science of learning how to tell if someone is lying. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, May 12th. We've got some low-tech lie detection coming up. I'm John Hockenberry, joined today by Farai Chideya. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, John. So coming up this morning, we're going to talk about health care. The Obama administration says it can get the industry to cut $2 trillion in costs over 10 years. We're also going to hear from Takeaway correspondent Andrea Bernstein, who's been in Charlotte, North Carolina. She says the city's preparing for the next economic uptick by tripling the size of its transit system. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
And in the headlines, Afghan officials say insurgent attacks in the country's eastern city of Khost sparked running gun battles today that lasted hours. Armed insurgents took government workers hostage and ambushed an American reaction force. At least four soldiers, two civilians, and an unknown number of militants were killed. One doctor said medical workers couldn't reach some of the wounded because of the fighting. Meanwhile, the Afghan government is calling on the new commander of American forces in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, to help reduce civilian casualties there. Kabul is asking him to increase the quality and quantity of Afghan forces. The U.S. announced yesterday that McChrystal will replace General David McKiernan as the top general in the country. Farai?
In Iran, American journalist Roxana Sabiri says she's very happy to be free and reunited with her parents.
I don't have any specific plans for the moment. I just want to be with my parents and my friends and to relax.
Sabiri was released from an Iranian prison yesterday. She served 4 months on charges of spying for the U.S. An Iranian appeals court suspended her sentence. In Sri Lanka, the Red Cross says it's abandoned its attempt to deliver aid and evacuate civilians from rebel-held areas.
It's a tragedy.
Yeah. And the organization says the situation on the ground, they just can't get in. The announcement came as Sri Lankan government forces said they'd launched a final assault on the Tamil Tiger rebels. And alleged Nazi war criminal John Demjanjuk is now in a German prison after months of legal wrangling. 89-year-old was arrested in Munich today, faces charges of being an accessory to the deaths of 29,000 people during the Holocaust.
Some more economic indicators out this morning. The U.S. trade deficit widened to $27.6 billion. $1 billion in March, slightly lower than what economists forecast. The global recession cut sharply into sales of American exports. Bad financial news from Asia. China announced its exports were down more than 20% last month. Hitachi, the Japanese electronics firm, lost more than $8 billion in the last fiscal year. And on Wall Street today, the Dow opens at 84.19. The S&P starts trading at 9.09. So $2 trillion in cost savings, that's what the Barack Obama administration is talking about. We'll have details about that in a moment. But what behaviors can you change in your life to help you get those cost savings? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Behavior changes and healthcare costs.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. It was the formal beginning of the debate in Washington on health care reform, and it sounded like this.
When it comes to health care spending, we are on an unsustainable course that threatens the financial stability of families, businesses, and government itself. This is not news to the American people, who over the last decade have seen their out-of-pocket expenses soar, healthcare costs rise, and premiums double at a rate 4 times faster than their wages.
The president, of course, is right. Nothing about what he said yesterday was news to the American people, but how the debate on health care reform proceeds in Washington will make news over the next several months if the process results in actual health care reform. And the way the debate began yesterday sounded very, very familiar to Henry J. Aaron, who joins us now. He's a health economist at the Brookings Institution and was a member of the Carter administration when that administration attempted to deal with health care reform. Henry Aaron, first of all, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
And the beginning yesterday involved a coalition of industry, private sector individual players in healthcare, and of course the president as the main public player in healthcare, coming together for a voluntary series of cost-cutting moves that involve creating incentives for people and the healthcare industry to do better, to control costs. Does that sound familiar to you?
Quite. It's the same group, more or less, that came together in 1977 with something that was then called the voluntary effort to slow the growth of hospital spending. I think there's a key difference, however, between then and now. Whether it turns out to be significant in the long run, we'll have to wait and see. But the objective turned out to be, in 1977, that the effort was a device for stalling the administration's effort to achieve economies, to stop legislation that would have put the federal government into the business of hospitals and pharmaceutical companies and so on. This may be a rather different situation because I think the administration has been very successful in communicating an inclusive tone to the effort to fashion health care reform, bringing in members of Congress and major interest groups. So yesterday's event was a good sign. It lacked specifics, and the claimed savings are rather large.
$2 trillion over 10 years.
$2 trillion, yes. Yep. And the proposal or the letter from the groups did not indicate exactly how that would be done. That's going to be a task, I think, for legislation than for the voluntary behavior by individual groups.
Well, we did a little bit of the math yesterday here on The Takeaway. It appears over 10 years you would expect to spend about $23 trillion on health care. Reduce it by $2 trillion, you're down to $21 trillion. That's still a huge amount of money. But let's talk about the incentives for a minute while we wait for legislation. And I think, unlike the Carter experience, there is an expectation that things will change with the momentum that Barack Obama appears to have. But aren't the incentives all on the side of acute care, not preventive care and the sort of behavioral changes that President Obama was talking about? Health care companies get paid for sick people, not well people, period, the end.
They do get paid for sick people. The idea that through behavioral change we're going to deal successfully with rising health care costs, unfortunately, is a delusion. This issue has been studied extremely carefully by numerous scholars, and a lead article in the New England Journal of Medicine about 6 months ago listed preventive care as number one on the list of remedies that wouldn't achieve significant long-term savings. The problem is, I hate to say this at breakfast time, but we're all going to die, and we're all going to fight that. So this is a bit like the old service station advertisement. You pay me now or you pay me later.
Mr. Aaron, I think the fact that we're all going to die is also not news to the American
no,
people.
No, it isn't. But it means that there are going to be expensive illnesses.
Yeah, but the incentives question is big.
Well, Henry Aaron, a health economist at the Brookings Institute, we're going to take a look at what those incentives mean to individuals who are attempting to figure out where their incentives lie in health care. Henry Aaron served as the Assistant Secretary of Planning and Evaluation at the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare during the Carter administration. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thank you, Henry.
You're welcome.
Well, you know, we've got Dean Karlan now, who's a behavioral economist at Yale University and co-founder of StickK.com. It's a site where you can form commitment contracts to help yourself with your personal goals. Now, Dean, I just want to get right into this because we heard from Henry Aaron of the Brookings Institution, and he used the word illusion to talk about these incentives of change. You know, illusion is a strong word. I mean, do you really think it's BS that people are going to change if there's incentives?
So, first of all, I think the simplicity is really what makes it work. I mean, do incentives matter? I think there's more or less no doubt in the world of prices that as price goes up, we buy less of things. Price goes down, we buy more. I don't think there's any delusion whatsoever that people respond to price. the question about healthcare in particular is, what prices do people respond to most on healthcare, and how can you make them more aware of those prices to help them guide them towards the choices that they want to make themselves?
Well, you know, this is one of those things where some people really think that this might work. I want you to listen to something from one of our listeners.
It's Steve from Chelsea, Michigan. One easy way to save money in the healthcare system to incentivize people to take care of themselves. In other words, like auto insurance, people who have more accidents pay more. People who are overweight pay more for health insurance. People who smoke pay more for health insurance. People take care of themselves, do not pay as much.
Dean, isn't that already happening in some cases? I mean, you know, there are all of these clauses about pre-existing conditions, certainly when it comes to life insurance, which is not the same as health care, but in the same general discussion, you do get penalized for smoking. You do get penalized for being overweight. Is one answer to make sure that people who jog every day and eat lots of vegetables get cheaper health insurance? What do you think of that?
No, that's exactly right to a large extent. And the key idea behind commitment contracts and stick is that for some people, they would actually prefer that. I would prefer to have it so that chocolate, M&Ms, soda are more expensive. Now, I can't control those prices directly. I can't get the M&M company to raise the price of M&Ms. But I can write a contract that helps increase the price to me personally. And I know that I'll respond to price. As price goes up, I will buy less of something. And that's the key idea behind a voluntary behavior modification approach that commitment contracts take.
So your site is called Stick. I called it Stick K because it's got two Ks, S-T-I-C-K-K. What exactly is it, and what do people use it for?
So the single most common use is weight loss. There are other uses that range from some kind of very normal type activities like smoking cessation or exercise. Some more creative uses like yelling too much, and my personal favorite is speaking too quickly to foreigners in New York City. And you know, basically it's any behavior that you want to change. And what you do is you write a contract where you put your credit card on the website and you say, if I don't stop this behavior, then I will owe money. And you can owe that money to either a generic charity or to your most hated charity, and it's what we call anti-charities. And the idea is that really kind of sticks it to you to help you change your behavior. And you name a friend or a colleague or a family member to hold you accountable. It's a really important part. And that person has the power to say, hey, you didn't do what you said you would do. Now you have to pay that money off to the charity or to that person as well. The money can go to the person who is supposed to hold you accountable.
All right. Quick thing from another one of our listeners.
My name is Jennifer, and I'm calling from Detroit, Michigan. And over the last 2 years, I've lost 75 pounds, and we're taking charge of our own health. And we've found that there are much fewer visits to the doctor. We're being more efficient with our own health care. I think it's time Americans stepped up and took responsibility of their own bodies.
Very quickly, you actually went and changed your own behavior. What did you do?
So I started doing this when I was in graduate school, and I signed a contract with a friend of mine to lose 40 pounds. And my friend also wanted to do the same, and we both lost the weight by risking that money with each other. And I've also used this for exercise contracts with friends to run on a regular basis and to get myself in the habit of being just more healthy overall.
All right. One last thing. One word. Will Americans make contracts with themselves to be healthier?
Absolutely. If they want to be healthier, then this is clearly in their incentives to do so.
All right. Dean Carlin, thanks so much. Dean Carlin, behavioral economist, Yale University, co-founder of Stick.com.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Jadea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. That was an interesting discussion there. We just finished on healthcare economics from the macro perspective and the micro, achieving savings with voluntary agreements at the top end of the healthcare economy, and finding incentives for individual consumers to make changes in their own lives at the other end. Well, where do you come in? What would you change about your own behavior to improve healthcare? Lose weight? Sleep more? Where do you draw the line? Here's Katie from Bristol, Rhode Island.
Stop drinking. Stop the drugging. Get a living will so that you can have a say in when your life is to end, because healthcare in this country is not the answer to solving your problems. Taking care of yourself is. Thank you.
Healthcare behavior changes. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Should I give up or should I just keep chasing pavements?
Oh, yes, she's chasing pavements all over America. Takeaway correspondent Andrea Bernstein is just back from the city of Charlotte, North Carolina. Why Charlotte? Well, we've learned that in this recession, you've got communities looking to merely survive with an infusion of federal dollars during these hard times. And then you've got some real big idea initiatives.
You guys always take the train in?
Yeah.
Why?
Saving the planet.
Saving the planet by riding the train? Well, the city of Charlotte actually thinks that mass transit is a way out of this recession.
Why do you think it would be good for the economy?
From here to Concord's going to be a major boom area, I think. And if they put the light rail, that's just going to make it grow that much faster.
Ken McCarver, construction worker in Charlotte, North Carolina, speaking with Andrea Bernstein, believes his city is preparing for the next boom by tripling the size of its transit system. So, Andrea, when transit systems around the country are having such troubles, why are Charlotte's plans for mass transit so ambitious?
You know, it's so fascinating what has been going on in Charlotte, North Carolina. The mayor there calls himself a conservative Republican, but he decided about 14 years ago when he got elected, he was going to put in a light rail system. And he had a whole plan, and he had a plan to fund it with a half-cent tax, and he got, as you can imagine, a lot of flack from a community where there's a lot of people that live in the suburbs that drive their cars. And he made the argument that this was a part of a business plan for Charlotte, North Carolina. Listen to what he told me when I was down there.
I will say this. The transit line is a great recruitment tool for bringing in new business and attaining business, because one of the major things I show them is that we're preparing for the future as opposed to reacting to the future.
The big idea here, thinking beyond the recession, how's Charlotte going to pay for this transit expansion?
Well, one of the things that it's done is it has had this half-cent tax, and there was a major effort right as this new system was getting launched about a year and a half ago, the Link system, to repeal it, and it was defeated by 70%. And it's really interesting because this has also happened in Denver. You know, when you poll people in the abstract and you say, would you like to pay more for infrastructure for transit, people almost always say yes. And here was a case where it was tested in reality, in real time, and people actually said they wanted it. And, you know, it's amazing in the context of what's going on that, you know, Charlotte does have this funding base. You look at St. Louis, they're cutting a quarter of their service. Atlanta is actually talking about cutting transit service one day a week, which is a sort of an astonishing thing. And, you know, what is amazing is that when you plan the transit system as it's been done in Charlotte, it does stimulate economic activity. I could see active construction, homes getting built, the sort of new dense housing right along the line with access to transit. By the way, this is exactly the kind of thing that President Obama says he wants to do. He set up a task force with the Department of Transportation and HUD to do this sort of development so people don't have to drive. And one of the ways they did this in Charlotte, I was speaking with Kevin Parker. He's the head of the system. And he was telling me about how they built the trains to look like works of art and to have stops in really convenient places right near the Bank of America, near the arena. And what's happening is that has actually removed a lot of the stigma of transit. You know, in a lot of places, people feel like only poor people or people who have no choice would take mass transit. But in Charlotte, you really do see a mix. And we took a little ride down the on the Lynx train, and we had a chat about how it was going. And he told me about an experience he had a year ago where there was a pretty unusual combination of people on the train.
So about a year ago, we had what we call the Monster Jam tractor pull. These big trucks run over top of each other. And And so you had lots of folks with jeans and T-shirts, and they were dressed for that event. On the same day, there was a formal event downtown, and so I saw a number of women with the nice sequin gowns on and gentlemen with their tuxedos.
So we're talking about tractor pulling the economy, though. That's Keith Parker, the chief executive of the Charlotte Area Transit System. Sounds like a guy with a lot of credibility.
Yeah, and what's amazing is that I did find this among the riders, and that in a city where just a year or 2 years ago they were talking about should they have a transit system, and now the question that people are saying, and rider after rider said this to me, is, you know, let's get a new line. Where is my line? And, you know, to have this kind of a discussion in a southern city where a lot of the development was this old sort of 1970s model, cul-de-sac developments, people would get into their cars. You know, people actually still do like that. One driver that I spoke to, you know, I said to her, would you take the transit? And she was like, I'm not so sure. Listen to this.
How do you feel about driving? You like driving?
I do, yeah. Traffic's not too bad.
So you like being in your own environment with your coffee cup.
Yes.
Getting to come and go as you please.
Yep, yep. Yeah.
And even though Charlotte is this, you know, newly blue state, there is still some, you know, healthy red state skepticism about taxes.
We're paying these increased sales taxes to benefit one very small slice of Charlotte.
So I'm wondering why Charlotte is making this big bet. I mean, they're not cutting back their transit plans, even despite the economic problems.
No, they're not. And one of the things is because they really do see it as the buffer. I mean, the mayor was saying that he's using it as a recruitment tool. They're signing up companies. You know, Charlotte is a town that has been reinventing itself since Reconstruction. And, you know, they're sort of looking to the next new thing. And I kept saying, you know, is it in the DNA? Is it in the water? But this is one of the few places in America where the leadership sees planning and transit as key to economic recovery. And there are signs that it's going to get to the city out of its, you know, 11.4% unemployment problem that it's facing now.
All right. Well, Andrea Bernstein, thanks so much. As always, keep chasing those pavements.
Thank you. And by the way, there's a slideshow of the system on thetakeaway.org.
We'll leave it there, and you can see Andrea's slideshow of Charlotte, North Carolina on our website and find out where her next stop is next time on The Takeaway. Femi Okay is here with the headlines.
It's almost 29 minutes past the hour. The U.S. military has charged a sergeant with 5 counts of murder and 1 count of aggravated assault. That's after military officials say that he gunned down 5 U.S. servicemen at a counseling center on an American military base in Baghdad yesterday. The Red Cross in Sri Lanka says that it has abandoned its attempt to deliver aid and evacuate civilians from rebel-held areas. The organization says the situation on the ground won't allow it. And back in the U.S., safety investigators were told that the pilot in the worst U.S. air crash in more than 7 years had trouble learning a critical computer system for the plane he was flying. Let's look at some top headlines making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
That's right. And I'm John Hockenberry here on The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea, and we are talking about healthcare. I mean, you know, just about everybody has a stake in this. And President Obama feels that way. He says he's going to convince the industry to make $2 trillion in cost savings. But as we've been talking about, it's really up to you. A lot of it is about preventative healthcare. And our question is, how would you change your own behavior to improve healthcare?
I drink more water during the day. I intake less sugar. I would really observe the portion sizes of what I'm eating can decide that I'm going to eat for one person and not three at every meal.
He's no longer on the seafood diet, John. I see food and I eat it. Anyway, that's John from Dartmouth, Massachusetts. And we want to know what you're going to do, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or what have you already done? Have you quit smoking? How'd you do it? And mainly, do you, you know, as well feel that this is going to save healthcare? My take at thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're going to move on to a story that's making a lot of headlines in the world of our personal assessments of how our relationships work, talking about Elizabeth Edwards, wife of former presidential candidate John Edwards. She's doing the media rounds to publicize her book Resilience, which is about her husband's cheating, her relationship with him, her family. She got a huge boost from going on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and now she has gone yesterday with a live interview on the Today Show.
You know, I promised I was with him for better or for worse. This was a lot worse than I had ever expected. But I thought, you know, that meant something when I said it. It still meant something. You know, it sounds odd, but except for this very big thing that he had done that was bad, thought I was married, believed now that I was married to a magnificent man.
Now that whole kerfuffle has New York Times columnist Randy Cohen thinking, is she wrong to put out her family, you know, and put them in the spotlight just to promote her latest book? He is the ethicist and columnist for the New York Times Magazine and writes a new blog for the Times called Moral of the Story. So, Randy, when is it okay for a writer to just say, oh, well, I'm just going to put our business out there, or, as we say, dirty laundry?
Right. Well, the best guideline if you want to write about your own life and you're concerned about hurting other people and balancing those two things is to write a work of immortal genius. If you're Boswell and you write The Life of Johnson, if you're even for fiction, if you're Jane Austen and you want to write Pride and Prejudice, even though members of your family discourage it, you should do it. I mean, I wouldn't give up one minute of the joy or the insights either author has given us.
Well, wait a minute, Randy. Did Johnson cheat on Boswell?
Johnson cheated on Boswell 100 different ways. Oh. If we mean by cheating, did things that would upset Boswell, he did it routinely. But it wasn't Johnson that objected to the biography. It was Boswell and Johnson's friend, their mutual friends, family members, who objected.
Now, you say it might have been better had she delayed publication until her kids were older and sturdier. Is the worst transgression, in your opinion, having to do with the kids?
The worst transgression, in my opinion, is a kind of hypocrisy that we, I think, can fairly judge Elizabeth Edwards by her own standards. And she said at the end of 2006, when she discovered the affair, that she was going to keep silent about it. Remember, during the campaign, she did it first because she was afraid of the effect on her children. Well, it will have no less effect now. I've noticed when you go on Oprah, one way or another, this permeates the consciousness of your children. It's a law of physics, I think. There's some kind of Oprah physics scientists delve into. So if it was wrong at the end of 2006, why isn't it wrong now, and why isn't she a hypocrite?
Well, because she wanted to have her own version on the record for her kids and not have it be told by people on, you know, Entertainment Tonight, for heaven's sakes. I mean, doesn't a mom get a chance to do that?
She certainly does, but I don't think this was a routine part of the public conversation until she made it so. But it's by publishing her book and by going on Oprah that it became a topic for Entertainment
Tonight. But Randy, she might not survive long enough to have a sit-down conversation with her kids as teenagers. This is what happened to your father. I mean, she's dying of cancer, for heaven's sakes.
Right, and it's a serious thing. One thing people do in such situations, when they're concerned that writing might injure those around them, is they simply defer publication. Often historians or biographers are compelled to do that because the only way they can get access to certain papers sometimes is if they say, well, you can't publish till after this person and this person has actually died because it could deeply wound them. That's one option she had. I don't think any child psychologist says the only way you can tell your kids what's been going on is by appearing on Oprah.
Well, you know, she says that she did it for the kids, you know, getting to your point about this whole situation. And, you know, let's take a listen.
I mean, I am doing it for my children as well, but I wouldn't do it just for my children. I do think it's important for them to have the image that I have of him without this piece, because I think it's important that we admire our parents.
I'm not exactly sure where she's going with that one, but it sounds like she's saying that she needs to do a rigorous accounting of the relationship and it's better for the kids. What do you make of that?
Well, I make of it what you make of it. That seemed quite confusing, that if 2 years ago the reason to keep silent was for the kids. How is it that 2 years later, the reason for going public is for the kids? There's a curious contradiction here, and it's the Ben Franklin quote again, isn't it? I think we've entered Franklin territory. It's how wonderful a thing it is to be reasonable creatures, because we can always find or make a reason for anything we want to do.
Well, wait a second. I mean, are you saying that she's just misguided and had the wrong impulse altogether, or is she couching her revenge against her deadbeat husband in this sort of, I'm going to do it for the kids?
Wow, that deeper motive. Well, I haven't seen her in a clinical setting, John. So there's a
limit. Come on, Dave, you're always backing away from the hard questions. Do you want me to act like a woman again? Like we do in every other second?
I can't judge her motives. It's very difficult to judge her motives. But we can judge her conduct. And by her own standards, she seems to have acted quite badly. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, you know, we have to wrap up here and go to Femi, because we always like the headlines. But just really quickly,
I love the headlines.
George Stephanopoulos broke this story that argued that basically Edward Staff was going to stab him in the back if he had a realistic chance in 2008. Just quickly, is that ethical?
For the staff to once the phrase "stab in the back" is used, what can I say? It, of course, it's unethical. But I think many people were deeply wounded. People on the staff were wounded that Edwards had this ticking time bomb in his life and lied to them. And they said, "Is there any reason we shouldn't work so hard on your campaign?" And he said, "No, everything's great." So I can certainly understand their anger. And if we mean going public and releasing pertinent information, I'm not sure I would characterize that as stabbing someone in the back.
Well, thanks to Randy Cohen, columnist for the New York Times Magazine. He's got a new blog called Moral of the Story. It's at nytimes.com/ethicist. Femi?
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, Randy. Good morning, all. In Pakistan, army helicopters continue to drop government commandos behind Taliban lines in the Swat Valley today. And Pakistan's army now estimates that 1.3 million people have fled the fighting in the country's northwest since August. Afghan officials say that teams of suicide bombers and insurgents have attacked two government buildings in the eastern city of Khost, killing at least six people. Armed insurgents took government workers hostage and ambushed an American reaction force. That's a great look at some stories making headlines this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. We got a major announcement yesterday of a significant yank in the chain of command in forces in Afghanistan. Here's Defense Secretary Robert Gates making the announcement yesterday.
After consultation with the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Commander of Central Command, and with the approval of the President, I have asked for the resignation of General David McKiernan. He will remain in command of both ISAF and U.S. Forces Afghanistan until such time as relief can be nominated and confirmed.
McKiernan is out after less than a year, or only about a year, of being the commander of forces in Afghanistan. And the replacement choice is Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal. He's a former special operations commander. The Senate has to confirm him. It's expected within 60 days. Rob Watson joins us, BBC defense and security correspondent in London. This seems to be putting some distance between U.S. forces and NATO forces. Rob, how do you view this?
I'm not sure that I'd put it quite like that. I don't think that I think NATO countries will certainly be somewhat surprised. General McKiernan, I think, was a pretty popular commander. But I don't think it puts distance. I mean, after all, the new general, General McChrystal, will be in charge of absolutely everybody. And I think the bottom line here is that if the new commander is able to kind of gain the momentum back from the Taliban, then I guess every country will be quite happy to go along with it.
But does this argue for operations that are more sort of black special ops, small groups, rather than sort of broad forces, the kind of militia building that McKiernan was so involved with?
I'm not sure that that's quite the distinction. I mean, it's certainly true that General McChrystal has been hired because he has this background in special operations, and he has an assistant who's also got a background in the non-conventional approach. But I don't think it's quite that black and white. I think this is more an issue of of the Pentagon deciding, I should say in particular General Petraeus deciding, that the approach so far has been somewhat too conventional. And it's not just a question of special forces, but of using the kind of techniques that were so valuable in Iraq. And I guess to put that technique bluntly, it would be trying to figure a way of primarily protecting the local population, winning the hearts and minds, and getting the locals on board.
Well, does that then clarify for you the mission in Afghanistan? So many commentators have suggested that maybe that mission is not clear. And is there an exit strategy based on this particular appointment?
Well, I'd say in the first instance, it clarifies something, and that is that the administration, that the Pentagon, and indeed some of America's allies, are very worried about the situation on the ground in Afghanistan. And in particular, they think there's got to be a reversal of momentum. We need to get the momentum back on the side of the international community. So I think it clearly signals that. I think it clearly signals that you're going to see some change in tactics, perhaps a bit more innovation, perhaps this idea of doing deals. Maybe that's not quite the right word, but perhaps creating local militias, working in a different way with local Afghans. But I think on that bigger issue that you first raised, this idea of do we now have a clear idea of what this mission is about, I think that doubt is still out there. And I guess one could express the doubt as those who think, well, is this just about trying to bring stability in Afghanistan and then getting out as fast as possible, or is it about building a democracy there? And some people, of course, would argue, well, you can't have stability without democracy, right. So you're stuck there anyway.
Well, the Pentagon is about to surge its troop levels in Afghanistan, and we've just heard the announcement of a purge at the top. McKiernan's out. McChrystal is in. Rob Watson, thanks so much for putting that in context. BBC Defense and Security correspondent talking about the leadership change and what it clarifies for the mission in Afghanistan. He joined us from BBC Bush House in London.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So we're talking about healthcare today. President Obama sees $2 trillion in potential savings by changing how the healthcare industry operates. But you are the key. How would you change your own behavior to improve healthcare? Here's Allie from Delaware.
I've lost about 15 pounds. I stopped eating fast food. I'm not drinking any alcohol at all. But my coworkers, one smokes, has a terrible cough, and the other one is always partying. It's not fair that my premium has to go up. The insurance companies should look at us separately.
That's one suggestion for how to change how healthcare works in America. Call us with your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org is email. Femi is here with the headlines.
Thank you. 12 minutes to the top of the hour is the time. Alleged Nazi war criminal John de Jamyuk is now in a German prison after months of legal wrangling. The 89-year-old was formally arrested in Munich today. He faces charges of being an accessory to the deaths of 29,000 people during the Holocaust, which he denies. One German woman says that she's glad that he will finally be on trial.
I think it's very important also for German history that this guy has been extradited to Germany. And I hope that if he is in charge or responsible for killing so many people, he will be convicted.
De Jamyuk originally settled in the United States in 1952. His family says that he's in poor health and is too ill to stand trial. The pilot of a plane that crashed in Buffalo, New York in February had trouble learning a critical computer system for the plane he was flying. That's according to records released today from the NTSB. The agency is holding a three-day-long hearing on safety issues that have arisen during its investigation into the crash. And finally, in D.C., the hot tickets tonight are for the White House. The President and First Lady will be hosting an evening of poetry, music and spoken word in the East Room. James Earl Jones will also perform, and White House insiders say that he will be telling jokes in the voice of Darth Vader. But the only way to get an invitation is...
Give yourself
to the dark side.
Or you can also watch the Poetry Evening at whitehouse.gov.
Love
it.
Poetry
reading. Oh, that's so great. Thank you, Fanny. That's great.
So, it's an old story. How do you figure out who's lying?
Well, I heard a shot.
You heard a shot?
Yes, sir. A revolver shot right inside the door.
Thank you, Mr. Prince. Your witness. What about that shot, Miss Wallace?
No, Mr. Mason, it isn't true. He's lying.
Mr. Mason, do you wish to cross-examine this witness?
I most certainly do, Your Honor.
I thought you could tell somebody was lying just by looking at them.
The question is never simply if someone is lying. It's why.
From Perry Mason to the Fox series Lie to Me, the narrative of truth-telling and deception is central to psychology, to sociology, it's central to literature. Huge narrative in human life. Benedict Carey joins us now. He's a science reporter at the New York Times, and he's here to tell us about a new interviewing technique. It's not a brain implant, not a high-tech device. No, it's an interviewing technique that determines the liars from the truth-tellers. Can even help you. Ben has a piece on this topic in today's special forensics issue of the Science Times section. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks, John.
You know, I love that this is a low-tech use of language to produce a test for truth and lying. How does it work?
Well, it's a structured interview which starts out by me asking you to describe a recent memorable event. It may be, for example, a concert you went to or something over the weekend, just to get a sense of how descriptive you are in your use of language, how you communicate, how spontaneous you are. And then I ask you about a specific event that's being investigated, whether that's a crime or a trauma or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And I record that conversation or that description you give. And then proceed from there in several stages to have you tell that story again in different ways, one of which, for example, is to encourage you to give me more sensory detail, like what you saw, what you heard, what you smelled, to sort of fill in the picture of what happened. Another phase, I ask you to tell it backwards. Now, this is a standard interview, and after giving it to you, I can look at that transcript and get some idea of whether you were telling a truthful story or a concocted story.
Now, how would you be able to do that? And why don't you just ask me a couple of questions to get a sense of how you're sort of drawing me out on the one hand and then sort of creating a record that you can compare subsequent questionings?
Okay. Well, let's say I'm asking you about something you did over this past weekend.
Okay, sure. I'm an open book. I'm an open book, Ben.
You're
ask me anything you want. I was playing baseball with my kids. We were outside. It was beautiful.
Right.
The sun came out. My son was whacking the ball. It was great. My daughters were running around. The wind was blowing. It was gorgeous. The lilacs were out. It smelled beautiful. I really was having a great time.
Well,
Ben,
that's a beautiful picture you've drawn.
Thanks
there.
Thanks for asking.
Yeah, that's extremely vivid. Except that some documents disappeared from the Takeaway Studios, and we know you were there because you were caught on video. Now there might be a good reason for that.
Right.
I wonder if you could tell us what you were doing there.
Well, I stopped by the office and went by my desk, just picked up a few things that I was told I needed, and then just left. I was there really for about 5 minutes. That's all, Ben. But I want to get back to talk about the lilacs because that was really beautiful.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, John, give me a little more detail about the office visit. Anything you saw? Did you see anybody? Did you hear anything?
Well, I saw some of our producers. There was, of course, our producer Leo was in the office. He's got a lot of hobbies, and he spends a lot of time there on the weekends. There was some food in the refrigerator, I remember, and that's about it.
Okay. All right. Well, now, so you've told one sort of beautiful, vivid, flowering story about playing in the park with your kids. Gives a sense that you really you're a descriptive person, and when you recall something that actually happened, you give it a lot of extra detail. But you had trouble doing that the second time around, describing why you were in the office. And so the thinking on this is that people who are trying to tell a false tale, they have the idea that they will stick to the facts, keep it tight.
I see.
Try not to contradict themselves.
All right, I took the documents. All right, Ben. Fine. Fry, you have a question.
Yeah.
That's the story. So by looking at these transcripts over the structured interview, the idea is that people telling the truth will add more detail, 20 to 30% more. They may even admit to making mistakes in their recollection. Much more likely to do that than someone who's sitting on the documents and trying to tell a doctored tale.
Something real quick.
Have you ever had any specialized deception training?
I've dated a lot of men.
Oh, that's bitter. That's from Fox's TV series Lie to Me. Any differences between how men and women lie?
Yes, they're picking up some differences. Women tend to be more descriptive in both conditions, whether they're relaxed and telling an honest tale or even when they're concocting one. Men are a little tighter in both situations. And so as this science and this study moves forward, they'll refine to make adjustments depending on who's doing the talking. But that's one general difference, yes.
Now, is this, we've got to go here, and I'm actually telling the truth, but is there an application, an obvious application for this technique, and has it already been applied?
The answer is yes and yes. I mean, police officers, detectives, and so on, draw on experience and instinct mainly to make decisions before going to interrogation. Is this person a credible witness? You know, are they telling a tale? Is this person involved? And so police officers, for example, would have use for this. The San Diego Police Department is interested in looking at this. See if it helps them to make evaluations, before they start to more aggressively interrogate people.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the main application.
Well, Benedict Carey, the state of the art in sorting the liars from the truth tellers involves a structured interviewing technique described by Benedict Carey, science reporter at the New York Times. His piece is in today's special forensics issue of the Science Times section. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, guys.
And we're talking about healthcare today. President Obama is looking for $2 trillion in voluntary savings from the healthcare industry. And we've been asking, how would you change your own behavior to improve healthcare? Dave from Michigan has this idea.
The way to keep healthcare down is pick a sport. And tennis is a sport for life. It takes care of mental, physical, and other things that would otherwise drag you down.
We also spoke with Takeaway correspondent Andrea Bernstein about federally funded infrastructure projects in the city of Charlotte, North Carolina. Herb from Charlotte wrote us to say, what wasn't reported by our mayor is that the Charlotte transit system is losing money hand over fist, and they've already had to cut the trains back and make cuts to existing bus routes. You can check out Andrea's slideshow about Charlotte on our website. If you missed anything, you can always find us on at The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.